Let us do a quick review of the Mishnah, 56a, bottom of the page. We proceeded into the Gemara after that, but I think it's helpful to refresh our memories just to go through it quickly. Elu dvarim she'en lahem hona'ah. These are things that are not subject to the laws of hona'ah. Avadim, Vashtarot, Vakarkaot, Vahekteshot, Ein Lahem Tashlume Kefal, Lo Tashlume Arba'a V'Chamisha, Shomer Chinam, Eino Nishba, Eino Sezachar, Eino Meshalem.
What page, 56A. 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 4. 4. 4. 56A, 4 in the English. Okay.
These are the things to which the law of Ona'ah does not apply. Avadim, slaves. Shtarot, documents. Karkaot, real property, land. Hekdeshot, those things that are dedicated to the temple. Ein lan tashlumei chefal, these same things that we've just mentioned. If one were to steal them, one doesn't pay the penalty of double. Lo tashlumei arba'ah, there are arba'ah v'chamisha. There are a variety of thefts that not only require a payment, a penalty of double, but a penalty of 4 or 5 times. We discussed what those were. Shomer chinam eino nishba. If a person is a shomer, is a guardian meaning a beli, somebody who watches out, and is not paid for his services, that's a shomer chinam. In case there is damage to any of those things that we've just mentioned. Normally, as I explained to you last time, the law of the Beili involves the person who does not get paid for guarding something, if that thing is damaged, that person who was the guardian of it will not suffer damages himself. You cannot sue him. Unless it can be proved that he was negligent. Right? How do you prove that he's negligent? He has to swear. He has to swear that he was not negligent. So that doesn't apply to these things we've just mentioned. Just as Ona'ah does not apply to it. Vinosei Sachar, similarly, where you have somebody who receives payment for watching something else, that type of a beli is subject to a lot of rules, but not if it's those things we just mentioned. All of them are excluded from the normal laws. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, Kodeshim shu chayav ba'achriutan leish lehem ona'ah. Kodoshim, those are objects that have been given to the temple for sacrifice. Okay? Now there are two ways of creating the sacrificial reality in an animal. One is to say, I will give a sheep. All right, I will give a sheep to the temple. And that's for the purpose of sacrifice. That's called a kodashim shuhu chayav ba'achriyutan. Sorry, that's the opposite. That's she'eno chayav shuhu. Sorry. Kodashim shuhu chayav ba'achriyutan. Those consecrated things for which you are responsible, yesh lahem ona'ah. To those things, ona'ah applies. Those things that you're not responsible for are not subject to the law of Ona'ah. What are the things you're responsible for? If you say, I am going to give a sheep to the temple, that means that you haven't given this particular sheep. And let's say this sheep, something happens to it. You know, it becomes injured. In which case, if a sheep becomes injured, you can't sacrifice it. If that were the case, still, it wouldn't make any difference, because if you haven't given that particular sheep, then you're still obligated with a similar amount. And there, the laws of Onaha would apply. But once you have actually said, this sheep, and that sheep is injured, then the laws of Onaha no longer apply. It's not a normal transaction anymore. Okay? Because once the sheep is damaged, then it's in its own unique situation. Whereas if you just say, I'm going to give a sheep, and this particular sheep that you were thinking of giving gets damaged, you're still required to give another sheep. Okay? You don't get out of it because of that one sheep that you had intended. Okay? So these things also are excluded from the laws of Onaha, according to Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says, Afa Malcher Sefer Torah Behema Umagalit. Also, when someone sells a Sefer Torah, a behema, an animal, or a jewel, Ein lehem onah. They do not have onah. No, we don't know why. In truth, we don't know any of these things. I mean, we just see the Mishnah states what the law is, and we don't know really what the reasons for these things are. Amru lo, their sages then said to Rabbi Yehuda, lo amru ela et elu. We don't agree with you. We don't include the exclusions that you have just said, that the laws of onah don't apply to a Torah scroll, an animal, or a jewel. No way. No way. They do apply to those things. Okay? Now, just my hunch is that the reason that they apply is because they're movable objects. And really, the essential issue that we're going to be dealing here with is, when is something movable object, or when is it something else? The most obvious other thing that it might be is real property, which is the way we normally speak of land. Okay? Land is not the only possibility here. There are other things that are analogous to land. Okay. So the Torah first says, Mina hani milei, the Gemara says, Mina hani milei, how do we know that this is the law, that it applies only to movable property and not to real property? Well, the Tanu Rabbanan, because we have a Baraita. Echitim karu mimkar la'amitecha, o kano miyad amitecha. This is the law of Ona'a that we had in the Torah. And you remember that was Leviticus 25:14. Echitim karu mimkar la'amitecha, when you make a sale to your fellow. O kano miyad amitecha, or purchase from your fellow's possession. Should be actually from your fellow's hand. Al tonu ish et achi. You shall not wrong a person, his brother. I'm translating it rather literally now, not the way the New English has it translated. Okay? Okay, so it says, V'chi timkaru mimkar. When you sell a sale, a mimkar. Okay? So then it says, Davar le'lamitecha, o kano, or you purchase. Miyad amitecha, from your fellow's hand. From your fellow's hand. I reported this to them this week. They said there's nothing wrong with it. you agree with this? It sounds like a machine just moved in here. Okay. V'chitim karu mimkar l'amitecha, o kano miyad amitecha. Davar hanikne miyad liyad. It says something that is bought miyad amitecha, from the hand of your fellow. Something that can pass from hand to hand. Literally, hand to hand. Namely, a movable object. A movable object. You cannot pass a piece of land from hand to hand, as long as you mean that hand to hand literally. Okay? And that is how the Gemara is taking it. The Gemara is taking it literally. Davar niknem miyad liyad, something which is purchased from hand to hand, because it says miyad amitecha, from your fellow's hand. Yatzu karkaot she'enan metaltalim. Therefore, this excludes pieces of land which are not movable. Right? So it cannot pass from hand to hand, literally. So we are talking now, we're taking this literally and not figuratively. Yatzu karkaot she'enan metaltalim. Yatzu avadim shehukshu lekarkaot. And similarly, slaves are excluded because they are always analogized to land. Yatzu shtaron, documents, promissory notes, are excluded. Dichtiv, because it is written, v'chitim karum mimkar. When you make a sale of a sellable thing, shegufo machor, which implies that the thing itself is sold, the gufo kanui, and the thing itself is purchased. Yatzu shtarot, that excludes documents, she'en gufan machor, because you're not really buying the document, you're simply buying the thing that's indicated by the document. De'en gufan kanui, nor is their self purchased. The enom din elilirayabahem, for they exist only for the proof that is contained within them. Right? You can buy and sell notes, but it's not because of the note itself, it's because of the fact that the note is proof of something beyond the note. Mikan amru, from here they said, hamocher shtarot levasam, if someone sells his notes to a spice dealer, yesh lahem ona'a, there is the law of ona'a. Now that is to say, why would a spice dealer buy notes? He would not buy them because of what is written in them, but he would wrap up spices in them. So indeed, you could wrap up something in it, and then it becomes a movable object. But if the value of the note is in what is written in it, that has no essential value, no inherent value. It is simply what is behind it.
It's not good.
Okay? Okay. Peshita. And then the Gemara says, this is obvious. What did I need to, you had to tell me that? That if you wrap up your spices in it, that it becomes a movable object? Obviously that's true. Well, it's not so true. La puki midar Rav Kahana. This is in order to exclude the case that was brought by Rav Kahana, the Amar, for he said, Ein ona'a lifrutot. The law of ona'a does not apply to things worth pennies. Because after all, even wrapping something up is still not very expensive. So Rav Kahana believes that the law of ona'a only applies where something has significant value. And here we therefore learn that that's not true. The law of ona'a even applies to something worth pennies. Okay, that's as far as we got last week. Any questions still here? Yes.
In regards to slave, the ona'a to slave, the buying and selling slave, I understand it's like karkaot, it's out. But the way you treat slaves, is there any indication about ona'a?
No, because ona'a has nothing to do with the treatment of a slave. It's other laws. Other laws. You're not allowed to mistreat a slave. That's because of other things in the Torah, not because of the law of ona'a.
Yeah, but the laws of ona'a will not deal, because like the 7 years, so
those are all different.
Or the way the treaty is.
Those have nothing to do with ona'a. They have nothing to do with ona'a.
So that doesn't go into them.
It just has nothing to do with ona'a. It has to do with the treatment of slaves. Yes, that's very relevant. But it has nothing to do with ona'a. Okay?
Is there an underlying principle here? I was thinking of things passed hand by hand. Those are things of small value, but then jewels can be passed from hand to hand. They could be of great value. What is the underlying principle
here? It could be that certain things are much more difficult to estimate their value. And simply by certain things that are of very high value, partly because of their demand, like a jewel, doesn't have an inherent value, it has its peculiarly priced because of the supply and demand of the thing and because people want it. To some extent, that's true also of land. I mean, we've just been through this in the apartment market here. Are apartments and houses worth what people were paying for them? Okay? So real property is weird. Real property is, well, let's say it's weird. It's weirder than other kinds of property. So I think that that's not unlikely what you just said. There may be something like that which is operating. It may be. The way, in fact, what I said last time, you weren't here last time, was that it's a little hard to tell in this kind of an analysis what comes first. Namely, we are seeing citation of Scripture here. Is the citation of Scripture coming in order to cite laws that are already known and to give them a basis in Scripture? Or is this law not known and we're simply learning the law on the basis of the citation of Scripture? You really, there's no way to know that from what we are reading, because it could be one or it could be the other. Okay, so it could be there's a general principle. It could be that general principle was sort of enshrined in common law, let's say. In the ancient world, land and slaves were always dealt with similarly, and so on. And this was part of it. But here you do see that it does have a source in the written law. And one of the things that the rabbis try to do is, again, either if it's a known law, they will try to place a scriptural basis to the oral law, and that could be what we're seeing. Or it could be that they're deducing something that they don't know until they've read the oral law. Possible to know which.
Do we know if there were auctions in public squares or
near? Yes, there were. We know that there were.
Would these categories be those which are more prone to having public auctions than other categories of goods?
Interesting thought. I don't know. It's an interesting possibility. I don't know the answer, but it's possible. Could very well be. Interesting to see. To just think about that is one reads the literature and see whether these kinds of things are more subject to auction as opposed to other types of transactions. Because it's true, even here, in terms of our experience, well, let's say locally, we have auction houses, right? And those deal with objects. Although they also deal with other things which frankly are an awful lot like real property, like paintings. Paintings are along the lines of what you were just saying. Why? When I read the price, somebody bought a Rembrandt last week at Sotheby's. Did you read that?
Right.
I bought a Rembrandt for, I think, $43 million.
Right.
The most ever paid for a Rembrandt. We had been in the Metropolitan Museum of Art when our son was here. We just went over there and we looked at the Rembrandt contemplating the bust of Aristotle, which is just an extraordinary, one of the great paintings of the world. And we were remembering when the Met bought that, I think it paid something like $4 million or $5 million, which was unheard. Nobody could believe that anybody would be so crazy to pay something like that. Then this guy, last week, in a terrible economy, you know, where nobody has any money, sure, nobody has any money, this guy spends $43 billion on a painting that's not such a good painting. I mean, to my very cultured eye, of course, it doesn't compare to the bust, contemplating the bust of Aristotle. I mean, that
Aristotle
is...
Contemplating
the bust of Homer, thank you. Aristotle contemplating the bust of Homer. I mean, that's a great, great, great painting. So what makes one painting worth more? You know, what's the value of these things? So maybe, yes, some of the things that are subject to auction... like that may be in the same category. Maybe they're more like land.
I don't want to sound stubborn, but I said before once it's a matter of opinion because, for example, the apartment market in New York, it depends how strongly the purchaser wants to live in that particular location.
Sure.
And therefore, he's willing to pay more than somebody else who would simply go by the average idea of it. Price of an apartment or a house.
No doubt about it.
You could say that about anything also. I really want to eat a tomato, so you know, then you're really going to have to pay for it. I mean,
that's I'm not sure. I can't really say that line of reasoning is necessarily true.
Lady sounds not sure. Like my student.
Okay, now Gemara goes on. Hekdeshot. Remember, you're talking about temple property. Why is that excluded? Why is temple property excluded? Amar kra achiv. Oh. The scripture says, when you make a purchase from your fellow, okano miyad amitecho, or when you sell to your fellow, you buy from your fellow, al tonu ish et achiv. You shall not wrong a person, his brother. Literally. Okay? So it says his brother. Achiv v'lo hekdesh. You can't say God is your brother. Alright? So brother means a fellow person. So in fact, if the ownership is the temple, then that's simply another totally different class. You know, not the same class. So this now is limited to humans. And frankly, that's logical, it seems to me. Because this law is designed to protect the human market, either the human market or the human being per se, and God is just in a different place.
What are the situations in which you would have buying or selling of temple property?
You would buy and sell temple property. There are a few kinds. One type of hekdesh could be animals. Could be animals. Or you could... let me just think of a good example. See if they give you one here. Didn't they give you an example here? 16. No, it doesn't. You could say anything.
Could it be clothing and things like that?
Yes, you could give anything to the temple. You can say to the temple, I give this to the temple. But the question is then setting a monetary value to it. Right?
So, okay, I was interpreting this, or I thought this was describing a situation where there's a purchase. Either the temple is selling property or is buying.
That it could also be true. It could also be true.
What would be the situations then where the temple is buying or selling?
Oh, it could buy a lot of things. The temple has to buy, for example, for repairs. Okay? It makes all kinds of purchases because it has to be painted. It has to be fixed. It has to be. You have to buy.
But does that fit this specific term of temple? Oh, so that any such transaction involves the temple treasury.
Correct.
So
it's just there. It's in its own category.
Correct. Any temple.
No, the temple meaning the temple. There's only one temple.
Temple long gone when this was written.
Doesn't make any difference. This is the law vis-a-vis temples, and it doesn't apply to shuls.
But the temple is gone.
Does it make a difference? The laws of the temple are laws whether the temple is here or not. So from a very practical perspective, this is not a practical issue. Correct. But that doesn't make any difference as far as the law goes. The law is just as interested as impractical things as practical things. When the Shulchan Aruch was written in the 16th century, Rabbi Yosef Karo said, Rabbi Yosef Karo left out all the issues relating to the temple. Because he said it's not practical. It's not relevant. So he left out everything. Of course, that's all he had to do. There were people who were not so happy with that. But Maimonides, on the other hand, who did a similar thing in the 12th century, when he did his code of Jewish law, the Mishneh Torah, included everything that had to do with the temple. Because Maimonides felt the law is a totality. It doesn't make any difference. You don't separate one thing from another. Yeah, that's exactly right. You better believe it. During the years, the years in the 30s, for example, in the 20s and the 30s, early religious Zionism, but again, it's not so early. It was classic. Prof. Cook, who was then the chief rabbi of what was then Palestine, he reinstituted the study of temple sacrifices. Because it was all preparation. He said, if we're developing a Jewish homeland, a Jewish state, we need to know what to do when the time comes. And so that was a central piece of his Torah study. When the Chofetz Chaim, who was a great scholar of Lithuania, came to the land of Israel and studied all they were studying together, Chofetz Chaim believed that the most important thing at that particular time was the study of temple sacrifices. All for that reason. Okay?
Which is the most cruel aspect of the practices of the temple?
Most cruel aspect? I don't see why. Do you eat meat?
You kill something living.
So what's wrong with that? I do it all the time.
I do it. Just make it right.
There's nothing wrong with it in Jewish law. There's nothing wrong with it in Jewish law. Jewish law is not a legal system that is a vegetarian legal system. It is a legal system that accepts that animals are used for human consumption and could be for divine consumption as well. The assumption in Jewish law is that it is permissible to eat meat. I'm not telling you you have to eat meat, but it is permissible to eat meat. And we are actually very much against the systems that say you can't. I mean, we're not saying that you have to. But to say that you can't eat meat, remember, Hitler, when he pronounced the Nuremberg Laws, at the same time as the Nuremberg Laws, he forbid the Germans to kill pigeons in all German parks, right? Because they were sacred. And not allowed to kill animals. Switzerland doesn't allow any slaughtering. Many countries don't allow any slaughtering. Norway doesn't is more or less against slaughtering. I don't see any connection whatsoever.
Well, whaling is okay.
Whaling, yeah. I don't see any connection between the appreciation of human life and the taking of animal life. And I say that very, very strongly. So I think that that's a mistake, and I think that Jews are the ones who usually pay that price. Which, again, I'm not saying you have to eat animals. I'm not saying that at all. But I don't think that one can conclude the opposite, that it should be considered cruel. I think the same is true as far as the use of furs. The use of furs to keep warm. I think that the argument could be made that these things are all part of the natural cycle as God has created the world. And that, in fact, it is a very humane thing to have a world in which we use the things in this world, probably for the purposes of which they were created. That there is a balance of nature that we can be part of. And I don't know that there's a balance of nature when we seek to destroy that balance. We're living with upsetting that balance. And that's not because of the animals. Strong statements.
Well, I'm not sure minks were put on this earth to keep people warm or else.
I'm not sure there's anything wrong with the fact that if they're there, that they could be bred and keep people warm. Why not?
Okay. It's not the purpose for which they were put here.
I know no purposes. I can't figure out anything. But I would only say that I can't see why one should assume that you can't do it. I'm not saying you have to do it, but I don't see why one can't do it. Yes?
Regarding the point of people, Rabbi Cook, others studying the law of sacrifice, I seem to recall reading several years ago people in Israel, a group in Israel, trying to raise a red heifer.
Heifer, yes.
I guess that's the same idea.
Same idea, sure. I'm sure there's... Every once in a while, some farmer feels he has a red heifer, and the reason why it's potentially good, is that it would cost a lot. That's a good example. He could sell a red heifer to the temple, because to get a kosher red heifer would really be very good. So it'd be very good for the farmer who found it. Okay.
And if I understand this correctly, then there are no consequences to overcharging.
Correct.
To sell something to
correct.
The temple. Correct. That's allowed.
Well, no, it didn't say no consequences. Simply the law of hona'ah doesn't apply.
So is there another law that...
It's not overcharging. It's an item for which you can't possibly, in the case of a red heifer, there's no market price for it.
Okay, but more generally, this seems to be saying, right, there's no law of
Hona'ah.
There's
no law of Hona'ah, correct.
But there's some other rule that prevents you from overcharging.
No, it's not necessarily a rule. Remember who's in charge. And the one who's in charge... What's that?
You cannot trick God.
Yeah, you can't... Don't fool around with God. So there is a moral sense here. And the interesting thing is the assumption is that moral sense really has significant power. And that the law doesn't have to worry about a lot of things, And we have that in our legal system too. When a person takes an oath, similar thing. The laws of oaths are fascinating. Why should we believe an oath? And why do you assume that people will actually take an oath that's true? Or shouldn't they take an oath that would lie? It's very interesting that by and large people don't. People take that seriously, particularly when they put their hand on a Bible. And that's the way that you traditionally do it. Why? Why? You know, I can't say that it's always true, but it seems to be pretty true. I don't know why.
It's the way they've been educated.
Yeah. Maybe education, maybe fear. I'm not sure what it is.
You have Martha Stewart example, where she took an oath and misspoke or lied and wound up in prison. So, I mean, it's pretty serious. It can be pretty serious.
Correct. Correct. It's not
it's interesting that you say of our custom of putting a hand on the Bible when we take the oath. I wonder if that stems from the priests in the temple putting their hands on the horns of the animal.
I don't think so. There's the laws of oaths. I think they have a different source. It's an interesting analogy, but I think they actually have a different source.
Is it one of the Ten Commandments that to swear in the using God's name? Because God's name is usually invoked.
You're correct. That's correct. And that is the law. That is the law of oaths.
That's why I assumed.
The law of oaths is based on you. Lo tisar shem Hashem l'shav. You shall not bear the name of the Lord your God in vain. Okay. So that's a very serious business. Okay. Okay. So we see that the law of temple property is excluded. Oh, now the Gemara says, well, I went over this rather quickly, and I didn't raise any questions for the first thing that Gemara said. Gemara said that when we're talking about the exclusion of land, of real property, and it had a scriptural proof for that. The proof was that it's something that moves from hand to hand. Now, even as I said that, I can't imagine you weren't thinking, well, that sounds like a metaphor. Would you never take it literally? When we say that something passes from hand to hand, we don't mean from hand to hand. In English, we don't mean it. And why would you think that in Hebrew we would mean it? We've decided somewhat arbitrarily to assume that this should be taken literally. But frankly, from a perspective of logic, why would you assume that? And, of course, if we're going to argue it, we'll have to show that sometimes, in fact, in the Bible, the word yad, in terms of property, doesn't mean from hand to hand. Doesn't mean something that is movable. It can actually be used in other contexts and to be used metaphorically, as if it means simply possession, which is what it means in English. It could mean that, perhaps, in Hebrew. So the Gemara says, Matkifra Rabba Babar Mata Mamo. Rabba Bar Mamo objects to this first issue that we had raised. Kol hechadichtiv yado. Do you mean to say that every place it is written his hand? Yado mamashu. This means literally his hand? Ela me'ata. If that were true, how do you explain the following? And he now makes a quote. Dichtiv, for it is written. And here we have a quote from the book of Numbers. It says, Ela me'ata dichtiv, vayikach et kol arzo miado. And he, Sichon, took all of his land from his hand, from the hand of the king of Moab. So, that's a terrific argument. That's a great argument. So there, it's obvious in the Torah itself, the Torah uses the phraseology of from his hand, for land. So you were telling me that the word yad excludes land. I'm showing you that in the book of Numbers, it's used for land. Okay? Hachinami, likewise in this case, Dechol arabiyad beham and akitla. Isn't it the case that he held the entire land in the palm of his hand? You mean to tell me that he held the entire land in the palm of his hand? Right? Obviously it's not true. Ela mirshuto. But it must mean hand means possession. And
or
it doesn't.
Responsibility. It could be took the responsibility of the land for him.
No, it means rishut. It means the possession. He took the possession of it. He took possession of it. Hachanami mirshuto. Likewise, in terms of our verse about ona'a, why are you interpreting in yad literally, hand literally? Maybe, and here, since we see it's used elsewhere in the Torah that way, it means from his possession, and not literally. And therefore, land would be included and not excluded from the laws of ona'a. Very good argument. So Gemara then has a good comeback. V'chol heich dichtiv yado. Do you mean to say that wherever the word yado, his hand, is written, lav yado mamashu, it is taken not literally? Do you mean to say that? No. V'hatanya, but I will show you from a beraita. Im himatzei timsa biyado. It's just in a few other places in the Torah that we have examples here. And there, in that case, if, for example, somebody steals something, and the matter, the thing is found biyado, in his hand. Ein li ele yado. I would assume, this is a baraita. The baraita is assuming that the verse should be interpreted literally. The Torah says, if it's found in his hand. How do we know? How do we know that if he steals it, and he's liable even if it's under his roof, or in his yard, or in his enclosure? Okay, let's say the guy steals something. He puts it in his house. The Torah says, miyado. Okay? So you might say just that miyado means possession. But the Baraita says miyado would mean it from his hand. How do we know also that it applies to his property if the stolen object be found on his property? Talmud Lomar, because in the verse that describes the prohibition of theft and the penalty for theft, it says, im himatse timatse. If be found, it is found. There's a doubling of the word himatse. Himatse timatse. Right? Mikol makom. Because the word is double, it is not only in his hand, but elsewhere in his possession. Oh, if you need a separate part of the verse to prove that it not only applies to his hand, but it applies to his possession, then obviously where it says to his hand, it means what? To his hand. That's the way it goes. Right? So the exegetical method here is to prove the expansion of the idea from other words in the verse and not from the word hand. Therefore, it's obvious, had you not had those other words in the verse, it would have meant just his hand. So here we see in this case that hand is taken literally and not figuratively. Okay? Now we'll take another one. That's just one example. Right? Vitu Tanya. And there is another Baraita. Now remember, the force of Baraitas in an argument is very strong. If you can show me Baraitas, these are Tanaitic arguments that go way back. If you can prove it from a Tanaitic argument, it's a lot of strength. Because the Tanaim basically have an accepted series of principles and understandings of the law, and they're not manufacturing things. These are simply the oldest layer of the laws we have them. Okay, but Tutanya, moreover, is taught in another Baraita, Vinatan Biyada. These are the laws of Gittin, the laws of a get. The Torah says, he shall write for her a sefer kritut, a book of divorcement, a book of cutting off. Vinatan labiyada, and he shall give it into her hand.
Okay.
Engli eleyada. I learn from this that the only way to present a get is biyada, in her hand. Gana, chatzera, v'karpifamina. If he were to place it in her possession, which is to say, in her garden, or in her backyard, or her enclosure, how do we know that he has still delivered the get to her? Right? Now, in fact, the laws of getting, you have to place it into her hand. But if it doesn't work out that way, if by some chance it should not end up in her hand, but in her possession nonetheless, is it kosher? Has he delivered it? It says, Natan viyada. Okay? Viyada, we understand, means in her hand. Not possession, but specifically her hand. How do we learn that these other places also are included? Because Talmud Lamar Vinatan, because it says, and he shall place Mikol Makom, any place which is hers. Aha, if that is the case, Tam Dekav Dav Rachman Vinatan. The reason that we accept the fact that it is possible for the man to give the woman the get and to place it in any place that is in her possession is because of the inclusion of the word Natan. Vinatan, and he shall give. Halavachi, had that word not been there, Hava Amina, kol heched dekatav yado, yada mamash, I would have said any time, because it's the word yado, his hand is written, it refers specifically to a real hand. Okay? So, Ela kol yado, yado mamash. Rather, now the Gemara concludes by bringing two baraitas, which show that in fact, in these cases, it's quite clear that the presence of the word yado means specifically a hand, and it doesn't mean possession. The shani atam deleka lemei marachi. But it is different there in the case of Sichon and the king of Moab, because it is impossible to say ele birshuto. It is impossible to take it literally. Alright? In the case, it is possible that there are cases where you can't take it literally. But the general principle that the rabbis are learning is that if it is possible to take it literally, you do take it literally. If it is not possible to take it literally, you do not take it literally. Okay, and there are a limited number of cases where this appears in the Torah. So it's not as if we're saying this in general. These are only a limited number of cases. We now see how to dispose of all other cases. So that leaves us back now, having acceptable the original premise, which was said because it says miyad. Or to purchase from the hand of your fellow, that we mean hand literally. Okay? So, therefore, it is movable property and not real property that is included in the laws of Onah. Okay? Questions? Yes?
On Natan Biyada, right, is there anywhere raised the question of acceptance? Because if you give one hand to the other hand must accept.
Yeah, it is, because the laws of Gittin, for example, it's crucial the laws that it be accepted. A woman must be willing to accept the get. And that's why we have the Natan Biyada. According to rabbinic law, it's crucial. And that is why, as well, the issue of property is not so simple. And why they have to find it, because it could be that if you allowed for the possibility of her property, if you allow that too openly, that he could just throw it on her property. That he could just somehow give it to her without her consent. Because that's the potential problem here. It's that issue that really is behind nearly the whole Masechet Gittin. I believe that much of the whole tractate of Gittin has to do with the question of a woman's willingness. And that is behind ever so many, it's like the argument behind the arguments in the Gemara. And that's why it's such an issue, because it could be done against her will. Okay? Questions? Good. Okay, we go on. Now, by Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Zera is an Amora. He raises a very interesting problem. Schirut, yesh lo ana'a, o ein lo ana'a. Is rental something that is subject to the laws of ona'a, or is it to be excluded from ona'a? Now, rental, meaning rental of movable objects. Okay, because we've already excluded real property here, so we're not talking about real property. So we're dealing solely with movable objects. But you can rent a movable object. And the interesting thing is, what is rental? And that's what the rabbis are now going to be dealing with. What does it mean to rent something? To what extent does the renter have rights over an object which are enough similar to those of ownership that we should say that the laws of ona apply? Now, what would that mean? That would mean that there is a market for rentals, and therefore the issue of market price is also crucial, not only in purchases and sales, but in rentals. And the question is whether the law of ona'ah in fact applies to rentals. That's what Rabbi Zera is raising here. Okay, and here the Gemara now fleshes out the argument. Minkar Amar Rachmana. Do we say that when the Torah says Minkar, that was the word in the verse, V'chitin karu Minkar, when you sell a sale, literally, and a Minkar must mean a thing that is being sold, when you sell a sale, Aval Los Chirut, is that to say that we exclude rentals? O Dilma Loshna, or perhaps rentals are included in sales. And rental is more or less, even though it's not exactly, it's a temporary sale. It's a temporary sale. Because we said that the renter has a whole variety of rights. It's a very interesting issue, rental. I mean, we have it in apartments. When you rent an apartment, I know I've had landlords say to me, God help, you know, it's the worst thing is to rent an apartment. Because the person who is your renter has all kinds of rights. And you lose the normal control that we assume a person has if he owns something. If you own an apartment, you lose most of those rights. Not all of them, but an awful lot of them as soon as you rent it to somebody. Okay? And that's the nature of rental. Okay, so it's an interesting middle area. Amar le Abaye. Abaye says to Rabbi Zera, Nikativ mimkar liolam. Does the Torah write a sale forever? Mimkar stamakativ. A sale by itself is all that is written. Hainami biyoma mechirahi. And a rental is considered a sale for a day. So it's a very interesting idea. That is Abaye's view, and it seems to be acceptable here. That the notion is that rental is enough analogous to a sale, so that in fact the laws of ona apply to the market for rentals. And that's not something we would have necessarily assumed. Now here's a second sort of strange case. We want to see unusual cases. Rental was the first case. Here's another unusual case. by Rava. Rava questions. Chitin. If you have wheat. Now, wheat meaning seeds of wheat. Uzra'an bakarka. And you seed, you sow the seeds into the ground. Okay? Mahu. What about that? Now, of course, the assumption is that the seeds have not yet taken root. Once the seeds take root, they are part of the land. They are part of the land. But before the seeds take root, right, we want to know whether those seeds are subject to the law of Ona'ah. Not exactly clear what is meant by being subject to the law of Ona'ah. And the Gemara is going to ask that in a little while. But the general question is, are they subject to the law of Ona'ah? Kaman dishadyan bechadadamyan v'yeshlen Ona'ah. Do we assume that this is like somebody who threw them in a jar? And therefore they're movable objects like anything else is a movable object. Okay? Or do we say that once you throw a seed onto the ground, the seed becomes annulled vis-a-vis the ground? Interesting problem. All right, we do have this idea of things being included in other things. And it's a very basic issue in the law, sometimes, when something is annulled because it's part of another thing. It's a basic issue in the laws of kashrut. Okay, let's say you have you're cooking a pot of meat. Okay, and you make a mistake, you put a tablespoon of milk into the meat. What do you do with the pot of meat?
Isn't it batel b'shishin?
That's what you just said. Alan knows, it's batel b'shishin. It is annulled 1/60. The ratio of 1/60 is enough to annul it. That whole idea is that when you have two objects together, at some point and in certain circumstances, they are considered, the smaller one is considered part of the larger one, and its own separate identity disappears into the larger one. So here we're applying that to grains of wheat. It's obvious the grains of wheat are infinitely smaller than the land that they're sown in. So do we say that once you have sown the wheat, it's no longer wheat, it's real property? Simply the very notion of batel b'shishim or batel b'whatever it is, that it becomes annulled by the larger quantity of which it has become a part. Or do we say absolutely not? Until that wheat has taken root, that wheat is as if you had put it in a jar. Namely, it's irrelevant that it goes onto the ground. It's irrelevant. So basically the issue here is whether one thing is annulled by another. And whether the presence of something in the land, whether the smallness of an object being present on the land is enough to annul the object itself. Its own independent existence as far as the law is concerned.
It is very often the case of sowing.
Very often the case of what?
Sowing,
yes.
Whatever it may be, and before it takes root, it is eaten by birds.
Well, that could be. That could be, but this is not the case here.
No, but yeah. It's an independent entity then.
Yeah, it is not. It is true that it is not part of the land.
Not part of the land, yes.
And it has not taken root. Well, the question is it part of the land or isn't it part of the land? Because you could also argue that it is part of the land. Okay? Hechidame. Now, the Gemara really wants to know, how should we picture this whole situation? Because the real issue here is, what do we mean by Ona'ah? Paul, you asked that question before. What do you mean by Ona'ah in certain circumstances? How would a person be wronged? So what are we referring to here in terms of the seeds? Now, the Gemara sets up some possibilities. Ilema, should we say, the Amar Ihu Shaddai Ba'ashita, if you say that the seller says to the buyer, I cast 6 sayas of seeds into a field. Excuse me. Then I'm selling you, and I'm selling you those seeds. So he says to the buyer, I'm casting 6 in. V'atu sadai, v'amre d'lashada ba'ela chamisha. And witnesses then come and say, mm-hmm. he only threw in 5. I remember 1/6 was the issue in Ona'a. Right? So maybe this is what they're talking about. Right? That the guy says, I'm going to give you 6. He throws them down. And in fact, witnesses then come and say, I only gave you 5. Okay? Listen to this. The Ha'amarava, if you think that this is the situation, and it's not an unlikely possibility, it could happen. But Rava has already said, "Kol davar shebemida v'shebemishkal v'shebeminyan." Every issue that can be measured, weighed, or counted out, afilum pachot michtei ona'a chozer, even less than ona'a. That transaction, well, either has to be redone, or it's void, or something like that. I don't know exactly what that means. Here, that's crucial. Look down at number 34. Look down at number 34. It's a very good explanation. If someone agrees to sell a certain amount of merchandise and delivers less than the agreed amount, this is a mekach ta'ut. This is a mistaken sale. There's no sale at all. Right? This is what we would call fraud. This is a case of fraud. And the laws of Ona'a are not to deal with fraud, really. Right? You'll see. Which is very different from Ona'a. The laws of Ona'a govern cases in which a seller delivered the agreed item for the agreed price. Very different. Laws of Ona'a, where a seller delivers the agreed item, however many he said he was going to bring, he brings. For the price, which is the agreed upon price that they both agreed upon. But that price was too high or too low. That price was not reflective of the market price. That is the only case we call Ona'a. That is what we're talking about with Ona'a. If the overcharge or underpayment was less than 1/6 of the item's value, the amount of fraud, and fraud is not the right word here, the amount of overpayment need not be returned. This is because the aggrieved party realizes that nobody can estimate the value of an object with absolute precision, and therefore he waives any claim he might have on the other for a small price discrepancy. Perfectly logical. Okay? If the overcharge or underpayment was precisely 1/6, we've read this before, the sale remains in force, but the defrauder must, or the overpayer, or the over something or other, depending whether it was the buyer or the seller, must make up the difference. Except in a land sale, which is excluded from Ona'a. Right? We've already learned that now. There, the 1/6 need not be returned. But if a seller delivers the wrong amount of an item, he is not giving the buyer what he ordered. This then is not merely ona'a. It is a mekach ta'ut, a mistaken sale. And the laws governing such sales apply to land as well. Right? There is no reason to exclude land from that unless we would have a biblical verse. What we are talking about the exclusions for are simply the laws that apply to Ona'a, and we see that land is excluded from Ona'a. Okay? Yes, sir.
Definition of fraud is what?
I don't like the word fraud.
Which fraud?
I don't know what you mean, because fraud is being used in English in 2 different ways. When we're talking about Ona'a, Ona'a simply means that one is either buying or selling at 1/6 or more over or below the market price. Right? That's what it means. So it's something about over or undercharging.
Right. I understand that.
But it's not fraud. It's not really fraud, I don't think. Fraud is more the laws of mekarta'ut, the mistaken sale, namely a sale which is concluded on terms different than it was supposed to be. Okay?
Error in judgment.
Well, either an error in judgment or willful. It could be willful also. Right? It could be a willful
this
desire to defraud.
This is what I asked to...
Correct. We brought this up earlier, and I said, eventually we're going to get to this. Now we got to it.
Yeah.
This is the example of that. So here you see, and this is the way the Gemara does it. The Gemara doesn't start, you know, defining all of its terms. In fact, it's not even talking about this subject. We're learning this subject as a result of an ilema. Can we say that the seeds that have gone into the ground... How is this a case of ona'ah? Shall we say the following? No, we can't say that, because Rava has taught us that a situation like that, where in fact you put in five and you're supposed to put in six, that is not a case of ona'ah, but it's a mekachta'ut. So now we have learned, we've really further refined the notion of ona'ah as a result of that example. And that's exactly how the Gemara works.
I think you could talk about ona'ah, I think about it, in terms of it must be a mutual mistake of fact by both parties as to value. And anything else is not ona'ah.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a mistake of fact as to any other kind of mistake, then it would be
possible
outside of ona'ah. In other words, both of this, from the footnote, it sounds mm-hmm. like both parties mm-hmm. have to be mistaken as to value mm-hmm. in the same way.
Interesting.
And then you get ona'ah. Mm-hmm. Other than that,
it's another way of thinking about it, but it's probably correct. I'm trying to think if there are any exceptions to that, but it's an interesting way of thinking about it. It's probably right. Okay?
There is an assumption that at least one of the two, either the buyer or the seller, supposedly know what they're doing value-wise. No.
No, but what Milt is saying is that both of them don't know what they're doing. Both of them.
Both
are mistaken.
If the seller knows that the value is there, and you've got a mistaken sale.
Correct.
The seller doesn't know that the value is there, and the guy overpays.
I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure whether that's true.
There's a time gap to that you can check the evaluation of the product after the transfer, so you can come back. So they give whatever. It doesn't matter if you have knowledge or not, as long as that after the time. Like you buy insurance, they give you 30 days to cancel it with no penalty.
Mm-hmm.
So they give you a certain amount of time to evaluate the deal.
Remember that my basic thought as far as the laws of ona'ah go is that their first concern is to establish a valid market price. You know, we tend to think of this in terms of individuals and the equity that individuals should have in the law. It may be correct. But I continue to believe that first is the establishment of a valid market price. And that is the issue insider trading. Of having information that is not, you know, that only somebody knows and there isn't a real market. And you've somehow done something to upset the presence of a real market. Here, as long as there is an acknowledged market, that's the only way to set a price, eventually. Because things have no inherent value. The value is always set by the market. Okay? Okay, now, having said all of that, of course, now we're back to where we started. We said, does the situation that we're describing with the seeds, is this a case of where the guy says he's putting in six bushels and instead he puts in five, we've learned no, it's not that, because that would be something else. So we're left wondering still what it is. So here's another possibility. Ela diamar iu shadaiba kedi ibaila. Rather, this is a case where a person says, the seller says, I have thrown into the field as much as the field needs to produce a full field. All right? So he's done what he thinks is right. This is according to what Milt says would fit perfectly here. The iglai, Milta, but later on it is clear, becomes clear, the lo shadaba debikidibai la, that he didn't throw it enough. Because the truth is, you really don't know until after the fact. You can assume that a certain amount of seed, when thrown into the field, will produce a full field's worth, but that's not a science to that. The reality is you only know after the fact. You really only know after the fact. Question is, well, maybe most of the time it's true, it's not a problem. What about the case where it is a problem? Guy had perfectly good intentions. He didn't try to deceive anybody. He did what seemed right. The buyer and the seller agreed. Well, what the buyer and the seller agreed on is that he would put enough in to make the field grow. But he estimated wrong. He estimated wrong. That, it says, is a case of ona'ah. Yesh lehem ona'ah, o ein lehem ona'ah. The question is, in that case, can we say that ona'ah applies or it doesn't apply? Why? Because we may consider that the seeds are a part of the field. Once they become a part of the field, now again, they haven't taken root in the field. They're just nullified by the field. Then it becomes real property. Real property is not subject to the law of ona'ah. Or do we assume that it maintains its own separate identity from a legal perspective, even when it is thrown into the field? That's the question we have. And this is the case that the Gemara is dealing with. Okay? Now that's a good case. That's a very good case. Now let's see what it says. Do we say in this case that it's like somebody who threw the seeds into a jar, to a container? Or do we say that the planter has subordinated the seeds to the ground? Right? They're nullified vis-a-vis the ground. Okay? Now, the Gemara goes on to say that there are other areas that similarly suffer from ramifications as far as these seeds go. There are other types of law that also relate to this issue, and that could be affected by whether the seeds thrown onto the ground are as if they're in a jar, then they're separate, or whether they're considered the ground. And he will tell us. Nishpa'in aleihem or ein nishpa'in aleihem. Does one take an oath concerning these planted seeds, or does one not take an oath? There are a variety of situations in the Torah where a person is required to take an oath. We mentioned one before,
Shomer,
which is the Shomer, the Beli, who is the Chinam, who does it without being paid for it. So the Shomer is one. But there are other kinds. Shvuat Modeh B'Miktzat. This is in note 37. It's a good note. Shvuat Modeh B'Miktzat is a partial admission. If a person says he's accused of having stolen 37 things, he says, no, you're wrong, I stole only 34. Okay, that's a Shvuat B'Miktzat. He has to take an oath that he's telling the truth. Now, that's a tough thing, because if a guy is doing something wrong, do we believe an oath? So that's the issue of law here. So there are cases where, in fact, we might, and always this is a case of movable objects. It's always a case of movable objects. Gaman deshadjan debachad adamyan v'nishpa'in aleihem. Do we assume that this is like a person who threw them into a container? Namely, they're still movable objects, and one can take an oath on these things. O dilma batlinu agav ara ve'en nishpa'in aleihem. Or do we assume that they become nullified vis-a-vis the ground, and an oath cannot be taken on them? Okay? And the Gemara goes on, the Gemara likes this question. And so it's going to press it even further. Omer, matirin o ena on mat, Omer, ein Omer matiran. Now these are the laws of Omer. The law of the Omer is, if something, you know when you take the Omer is taken, when do we start counting the Omer?
Second day of Pesach.
Second day of Pesach. Okay, the second Seder, we count the Omer.
The first day.
That's the second Seder, or the second day, first day of Chol HaMoed. First day of Chol HaMoed. Well, in the first day of Chol HaMoed in Israel, second day of Yom Tov here. The second Seder, we do it here in the diaspora. So, if a person, let's look at what the Omer is. Until the Omer is taken, you are not allowed to consume new grain. Grain that has been planted in the land. And that's the law of Chadash. You are not in any year, only after the Omer is brought to the temple. Of course, it's different in our time because we have no temple. But when the temple stood, the Omer, which was a bushel, an amount of barley, had to be brought ceremonially to the temple. Only after that barley was brought to the temple could the grain that had grown that year be consumed. Now, the barley is the first grain. Wheat doesn't grow until the summertime in the land of Israel, and generally speaking. The first thing that grows is barley. First thing is barley, and the Omer is of barley. Okay? So, if you have things that come before, if your seeds have rooted before you take the Omer, then as soon as you take the Omer, those things become permitted to eat. Even if they're not then permitted immediately, but in theory they become permitted. Okay? If something doesn't take seed until after the Omer, then you can't eat it until the next time the Omer is taken, which will be a year later. Okay? So that's how the law of the Omer goes.
And they're only referring to barley?
No, that refers to wheat as well. Correct.
So if the wheat takes root after the
taking of the Omer, you
can't
eat
it
until the next
year.
Correct. Wheat doesn't work that way. Wheat, you plant wheat in the fall. You don't plant wheat in the springtime.
But you harvest wheat in the fall.
You harvest wheat in the summer. You harvest wheat in the summer.
Two wheat crops.
There could be two wheat crops, but you don't plant it in the spring. It takes a whole year to grow. It's a long growing season for wheat. It has to germinate and grow throughout the winter, because where does it get any water? Gets its water in the winter time. Okay? That's how it gets its strength.
But they planted the wheat after they harvested the barley.
No. You harvest the wheat after the barley. You plant wheat way ahead of time.
Are they both planted in the fall?
Well, I can't say for sure. I'm not sure exactly when. I believe they're both planted in the fall. Yes.
But barley
is the faster maturing of the crops. Barley comes up first. Barley is a simple crop. It's not a very refined crop the way wheat is, which is why dark bread, barley bread, is considered to be very poor bread. It's the poor man's bread, barley bread.
How do you know when you buy a loaf of bread where the wheat, which wheat you're eating, the new one or the old one?
Well, that's why it's great. Chadash and Yashan. In Jewish law, very frequently in a kosher bakery, will tell you that this is, always will say, Noshan. This is old flour. It's all, that has to do with these laws. This is just impossible. And it gets cold.
What? I have somebody
to fix this. Talk to the executive director. This is ridiculous.
This is fixed.
Yeah, this is you got a first line. We have, and for this we pay. We pay money.
We get discounts.
Kriya, yeah. And this is, I'm sure this is cold air. Doesn't it feel like
yeah,
it's cold
it
air?
Is.
It's cold
air. For this appointment?
For full price, you get hot air and no
noise. For the first.
So it's fraud and not ona. They didn't provide the food.
Okay. So, Omer Matiran, and Omer permits the wheat, the barley, let's say the wheat, okay, that has taken root. If it takes root after the Omer, then it has to wait till the next one. Right? Omer Matiran or Ein Omer Matiran. Does the Omer permit the consumption of planted seeds? How about if you plant the seeds and they haven't taken root? Okay? And you want to eat them. Because you want to eat the seeds. Okay? You decide that you like to eat the wheat seeds. Seeds are edible. They're edible. They may not be desirable, but they're edible. If you're hungry, you can eat the seeds.
Yeah, this is a dire straits. You would eat your seed corn or
seeds are edible.
It, you're going to eat it.
Correct. Your seeds are edible. So the question is, even though the law of the Omer usually goes to that which has taken root, that's definitely true as far as the growth of the seed. What about not the growth of the seed, but if you should decide to eat the seed itself and not let it grow? Does the fact that it has to become part of the earth for any significant period of time mean that from a legal perspective it is part of the earth? And therefore, when the Omer, you have to wait until the Omer comes? Or is the Omer irrelevant to this? And it's just like you threw it into a jar. Okay. So here we see another area of law which is potentially being affected by how we understand the nature of the seeds that have been thrown into the ground. Okay? The Elo Tanina, we learned in a Mishnah, Idala Ashrush. If you say that it is a case where the seeds have not yet taken root, Tanina, we have also learned about such seeds in a Mishnah. And the Gemara quotes it, Ditnan, Im Hishrishu Kodim La Omer, if the seeds have taken root before the Omer, Omer Matiran. The Omer makes them permissible. The Im Lav, Asarina Chiyavo Omer Haba. They are forbidden until the next Omer is taken. Now the Gemara says, Lotzricha dechat dinhu vizarinhu kodem la Omer. It was necessary to inquire only about a case where the planter harvested grain kernels. That's what I'm talking about. He harvested the grain kernels. The Atale Omer v'chalif alavayu. And the Omer offering came and passed with them in the ground. Right? The kernels are still in the ground. They haven't taken root yet. The Omer is taken. V'la ashrush kodem la'omer. They have not gone to root before the taking of the Omer. Mahu lemin katamecha minayhu. What is the law with respect to taking the kernels out of the ground and eating them? Right? Is this permitted after the Omer offering or not? Okay, the Omer has been taken. And normally we would say that you can't eat it until the next Omer. But these things haven't actually gone to root yet, but they were in the ground. Okay? Kamanda shadini bakad yadamei. Are they, the planted kernels, viewed as if they were thrown into a container? Visharin hu omer. And the omer therefore makes them permitted for consumption. O dilma batlinu agavara. Or perhaps the planter has subordinated them to the ground. And the answer is teku. Now, teku means we don't know. And that applies, apparently, to all of the above questions that have been raised. Very interesting conclusion that is brought. Tego is where we've tried to create situations of logic. And the logic, we've pressed and learned certain things as a result of the logic, but we really cannot determine this on the basis of the logic itself. Okay? So as far as the Gemara is concerned, this is a case of Tego.
The rent also?
Huh?
Renting also?
No, the rent was before that. That was ahead of that. Right. Right. This is the case of the seeds.
It's interesting that they are talking about the seeds from Omer to Omer. Usually, the way it goes, once you have the Omer, part of it goes for Kemach, and part of it is accumulated for next year or year later. So usually when you have seeds, it's probably 3 or 4 years old. It's already out of the cycle of Omers. So there is no issue.
I don't understand. What do you mean? When the seed itself?
The seed was good before you planted it.
Mm-hmm.
The chitar. Let's say this is year one. So we have the chitar. Some of it, we sell it or give it for kemach.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it, we accumulate it, like what Joseph did in Egypt, mm-hmm. for 7 years.
Okay.
So really seeds that goes back to the agricultural cycle,
mm-hmm.
are not fresh from Omer to Omer.
Oh, that doesn't matter. We're not worried about that. The question is, and that's true, the seeds
it's
would be perfectly...
after the Omer cycle.
Correct, so that they're perfectly consumable.
Right.
The question is, what if you put them in the ground?
No, but why they are an issue of that? Because if it's in a jar or in the ground or whatever,
because
the law of the Omer.
The question, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Once they're put in the ground, if you given the logic that you just said, when they sprout and when they seed, when they go to seed, when they root, you would say, well, they've already been permitted by the previous owner, right?
Right.
But that's not true, because now they're new
plants. They're not rooted. They're old seeds. I can do whatever I want with them.
Once they become rooted, it's easy. We know that the definition of the thing is that once it becomes seeded, once it becomes rooted.
It's late.
Okay. The question is, we have a middle ground here. We simply have a middle ground. It's not a middle ground before they're put in the ground. It becomes a middle ground once they've been put in the ground. And the question is that a middle ground? And the answer is, we don't know. That's the answer. Alan, what do you say?
No, I the same thing. I didn't realize they were 3-4 years old, but they were good up until the time I planted them. And
correct.
2 minutes later, I put them in the ground. And now I can't, you know.
Correct. Well, that would be the question. But it's the question in all of these. In every one of these cases, we have a middle ground. What's interesting is that the Gemara does not decide this. And this is probably, I think this is the first time this year we've seen a teku.
Yeah, that's the first
time. It's the first one. A teku is understood in two ways. Teku Taf Yud Kuf Vav. Tishbi Yitaretz Kushyot Ve'abayot. One of the understandings of Teku is that it's initials. Tishbi, when Elijah the prophet comes, Yitaretz, he will solve all of the questions and difficulties that have been unsolvable until then. In other words, this has to wait for the Messiah. When the Messiah comes, part of his job will be to teach Gemara. And the Messiah will then solve all the problems that we couldn't figure out ourselves. It's absolute logic. Based on our logic, we are incapable of it. So that's one understanding of it. The other understanding of it is teku is an Aramaic word, which means ta'amot. Ta'amot. It's we shall stand. In other words, the issue stands.
Unsolved.
You presented a good argument. You presented a good argument. We have no way to solve this argument. Move on to the next question.
Okay. Also says that the argument might not be worth worrying more about either.
Maybe. No? I'm not sure. Well, in fact, you're right. Because if there is no, if the Gemara does not solve this, it probably isn't all that significant.
Right.
Probably. But it is, as many things the Gemara does, is to simply raise issues. And along the way, we learned a lot about this. What did you know about Omer before you came here tonight? Okay. What did you know about the laws, these laws of seeds, and Batel B'Shishim? All these things. That's the way the Gemara works. All of these tangential issues are not really tangential to the Gemara. Rather, that's the purpose of the study in the first place. And some of the things that you think you might be learning, you won't learn. Some of the things you do learn, you never expected you would know.
You might not need to learn.
Yeah, but
go on with life.
Some, you can see questions with genetic engineering, with the with plants.
All of these issues are applicable in a million different areas. These are logical issues that have to do with things that are applicable in a million places. It will be continued in 3 weeks.
Three weeks.
Safe trip.
Thank you very much.